Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we focus on the Women's Community, a nonprofit organization serving the victims of violence, domestic abuse, and sexual assault in Marathon County. The organization serves women in crisis, providing a refuge at its shelter in Wausau, along with counseling, help for children and teens who have been abused or assaulted, and support services for the victims of domestic abuse and sexual assault. Our guest today, Jane Graham Jennings, the Executive Director of the Women's Community, Jessica Lind, the Sexual Assault Victim Services Program Coordinator, and Denise Lang, Volunteer Coordinator at the Women's Community. This is a serious topic that only recently began receiving the kind of attention it deserves. Domestic violence and sexual assault are problems that affect all of our communities, urban, suburban, rural, all age groups, all income groups, and all races. The problem is compounded by other factors: financial stress, mental illness, alcohol and drug abuse, poverty, and deeply seated cultural attitudes. But as we will hear, those factors are not excuses for abusive or violent behavior. We really want to hear from you today. Have you been abused? Do you know someone who has? Do you know someone who has stayed at the Women's Community Shelter and been helped? We want to hear your questions, your comments, and stories, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Jane, Denise, and Jessica, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You. Thank you.
Jane, tell us a little bit about the history of the Women's Community for those who might not know it.
Sure. It's a private nonprofit organization. Mostly, we're about 46% funded by state and federal grants, but we're also funded most importantly by generous community support, so that's where our support comes from. The organization was incorporated in 1978, so we have been serving Marathon County since 1978 in a variety of services. One of our services, the one that people seem to be most familiar with, is our shelter, but that's just one of the many services we provide. Our shelter opened in 1982, and since that time has grown and expanded to our most recently, our rather new location we've been in since last April, where we can house up to 40 women and children in that shelter. Additionally, we have numerous other programs that provide services for a variety of different people. In that, domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking know no bounds. They affect all socioeconomic classes, races, ages, and even gender. We do provide services to male victims as well as female victims because they're statistically more women experience this type of violence, but men can be victims as well, and we serve them just the same.
Let's talk about that new shelter building. It was a big deal getting the money to build it. The community came forward, and quite a feather in your cap, and quite a nice addition to the community.
I can never never tell this community how much we appreciate the way they have believed in us and the way they believe that victims of violence deserve something more and are more than just an afterthought. The way that they came together and cared about this project, it was really quite amazing, and we were overwhelmed by the amount of support from various people, from foundations to companies to individuals that came together. And one of the most telling things that happened, we have a donor recognition wall in a reception area. And when we moved our families over from the new facility, or the old facility to the new facility, they went up to that wall and they were looking at all the names that were on there. There's nearly 1,000 names who donated to make this project possible. And they just, with tears streaming down their face, said, "Why would they do this? I'm nothing." Because when people come to us, if you have to come to the Women's Community, something really horrible has happened in your life. No one wants to have to come there. So they really believe that they're worthless and that no one cares about them. And what we are able to do with all of those people who donated, these complete strangers, we're able to say to them, "You see, people do care, and here are the names to prove it." And that is what touched those women the most. They were overwhelmed.
Denise Lang, what's it like working in that shelter building?
It has been very refreshing for staff, for the clients that we're serving. I had talked with somebody that I met with today, and I hear this over and over again as new people are coming in to meet with me for volunteer opportunities. They describe it as being very homey, and that is the goal that all of us wanted to achieve. For this is, when someone's coming to us, this is their home. We are their safe space, and we want to provide that for them. So it's been wonderful, again, to be able to provide that for our clients, but also to be able to get that encouragement as a staff member to say, hey, you know what, the work that we're doing, people believe in us.
Jessica Lind, a building like that, it's just infrastructure supposedly, right? But a building like that has got to help you with your job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for many victims, particularly sexual assault victims, there's a lot of shame associated with telling what has happened to them. And so to be able to come to a warm, inviting place where you are welcomed and have a safe place to come and talk about what has happened has been really great. Many clients that I've worked with over the years felt like they could really come and just share in a safe, warm, inviting space. So it's really been great for that as well.
Now, Jane, you say you've got space for 40 women and kids. Is it usually full?
Since we've moved in, we've been nearly full to capacity, yes. So I think partially it's because people heard that we were building a new facility, so that has something to do with it. And also I simply think the fact that it is a place that they're able to stay now. The old facility, we were able to house 28, and they had to share a bathroom. And that just doesn't provide dignity or security for people who are complete strangers in crisis, all being forced to live together in a situation they don't want to be in. And so the new facility, we were very strategic in that design, that every room, every family would have at least its own individual bathroom. So in their most private moments, they wouldn't have to be sharing that with complete strangers. And I think that makes a world of difference. When people walk in, they don't feel like this is worse than where I came from.
And people who have had their lives shattered are going to need a certain degree of privacy.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And part of the whole project and what we wanted to do and the feeling that we want the place, it is more than a facility because it's about the attitude that we put forward as a community to say, you deserve more. You deserve to be surrounded by comfort and warmth and security, and that's what the community provided.
Well, what's the average stay at the shelter?
Our average stay right now is about 28 days. It varies depending on individual situations, so we work with families based on their needs. It is a short-term emergency shelter, so people turn around pretty quickly, but the average stay is about 28 days.
What happens to women and children who are being abused, who are at risk when the shelter is full? Where do they go?
We work very closely with other shelters in the area. So within the 72 counties in the state of Wisconsin, there are domestic abuse programs in every county. There are not shelters in every county, but in central Wisconsin, all of our surrounding counties have shelter with the exception of Clark County. So if we are full, we work with other counties in particular. We work with a program called Haven, which is in Lincoln County, to see if they have availability, and then we find ways to transport clients there until we have space available for them.
Is your shelter the biggest in north central Wisconsin? It's certainly probably one of the most modern.
Yes, it's the largest in the area, yes.
Do you often, and I know the answer to this already, but do you often receive threats, visits from men demanding to see the women that they've assaulted or abused? How do you handle security issues?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that we have is we are a very secured facility. We have video cameras that record every entrance and exit of our facility. We have video surveillance throughout all of our parking lots. We have a security system. You cannot gain access to the facility without key cards or without being let in by a staff person. And that is to ensure the protection of the people that we're serving. But the issue about abusive people coming to the facility is really interesting because it's really a paradigm shift. The women's community is a public agency. We publish our address. We tell people where we're located, and we do that by design and by intent because we don't exist without community. The community owns this issue. It's a community problem. We don't exist without the support of the community, so it's really off-putting when a donor would call and say, I have some clothing that I would donate, but where are you? And for us to say, I'm sorry, I can't tell you where we are. We changed that a number of years ago to say, here's our address, here's where we are, for a couple of reasons. One, we want the community to know that they are part of this and they can come to our agency. And secondly, it's a paradigm shift for how we deliver the message to victims as well as perpetrators. Victims shouldn't have to be ashamed to come to our agency. The shame belongs to the people committing the violence. And with most abusive people, they don't want anyone to know they're abusive. So they don't tend to come to our agency. They don't want people to know who they are. They still harass and torment their victims, maybe by cell phone or other things, but they don't often come in to the facility. If they do, really it's usually a matter of us saying you need to leave the premises, and if they don't, we contact law enforcement, and that's usually done pretty quickly.
And I imagine they respond pretty quickly if they get a phone call from you.
Absolutely, they do. Our law enforcement is pretty incredible in this community.
What's your budget? How much does it cost to run a shelter program like that and all of the other programs that you do?
Our entire agency budget is just about $1 million annually. And that includes all of our programs, which includes our shelter program, our long-term supportive transitional living program, our abuse in later life program, our healing through art program, our Southeast Asian advocate program, and our Hispanic outreach program, and our sexual assault victim services program. So we have a variety of services that we provide, in particular specific cultural services that we provide. We have bilingual bicultural advocates to provide services specific to those communities.
Man, you do a lot of stuff at the women's community. How many people do all of this? How many are on your staff?
In total, we have 28 full and part-time staff. We are a 24-hour operation. We have a 24-hour support line, and there is always a warm human being that will pick up a phone and answer it if you call our support line. So we have to staff that 24 hours a day, no matter what holiday it may be, no matter what the weather may be, no matter what else is going on, we are there for people 24 hours a day. And another service that I think Jessica can speak to that people aren't aware that we do is we provide after-hours on-call response to sexual assault victims when they present to the emergency department.
Yeah, Jessica, why don't you fill us in on that?
Sure. We because we are a 24/7 operation, and crime is happening, unfortunately, all the time, we are responding out to our emergency departments to work closely with our sexual assault nurse examiners in our community. And so we're responding to victims who've been impacted by sexual assault, whether they're children or adolescents or adult victims. So our advocates are trained, and we also have volunteer advocates who are trained, who will go out and offer support, information, making sure that victims are connected to community resources, making sure they have a safe place to go after an assault occurs.
Do you end up showing up at emergency rooms sometimes?
We do. The majority of people who go for medical attention would go to the emergency department, and advocates would then respond out to that emergency department and offer information and emotional support.
How do you find out about this? Do they tell you in the emergency room, or
We have a collaboration with both St. Clair's and Aspires hospitals, mm-hmm. In which advocates are called in to respond to victims, and so
they work hand in hand with you.
Yes. Yep. So we work very closely with the sexual assault nurse examiner programs in both hospitals, where then we would work together as a team. And if the victim chooses to make a police report, then we would also work with law enforcement. And so we really respond as a sexual assault response team in our community, which is really fantastic for victims, for all of us system folks to come together and offer support and information.
Now, Jane mentioned of course, the full and part-time staff. She also mentioned volunteers. Denise, yes. Tell us about the volunteers. So those are the people you work with.
We do. Our volunteers are wonderful, and quite frankly, you can't function without them. So we have a multitude of volunteers. We have, you know, several that just came on board. We have several long-term volunteers, which are fantastic. They are providing services such as childcare. They are helping answer our phones, whether mm-hmm. it's in our reception area or up in our support line office. They are also providing respite childcare. If a shelter resident needs to go out to a physician appointment, we may have a volunteer available to come in and help them out with childcare if they need that. Jessica mentioned that we have on-call volunteer advocates. We have a
What's a volunteer advocate?
Essentially, they are trained to help and assist with the role of the advocates. So Jessica just talked about responding to the emergency departments, and we have volunteers who are very dedicated and commit to helping us in respond to the ER.
So a volunteer could go out to the emergency
Absolutely.
Department and work right with the police, work right with the emergency medical technicians,
yep.
and
Correct.
And they
yep.
don't ask for an ID and say, are you a full-time person at the women's community?
Correct. They are representatives of us, and that That is, the volunteer staff that we have are very, very dedicated to us.
Well, what kind of people would want to do this, you know, to help out in these kinds of situations? It seems to me you'd be dealing with a lot of trouble, an awful lot of stress, maybe some danger, a lot of people in crisis. What kind of a person would want to volunteer?
They're remarkable people. It's a lot of individuals who want to give back to the community. That's what I hear a lot, is I want to find a way to give back. A good portion of them have been affected by whether it's domestic violence or sexual assault in their life, or they've had a family member or a friend affected, and they want to find a way to give back. Whether they have been have sought services through our agency or an agency in another state, they want, this is something that people are passionate about, and I think it's a way for, within our community, for them to feel like they're making a difference. And they certainly are every day that they come in. So,
and for victims, it's so often that they feel like they are alone and it's the only person that this happens to. And so for people who are survivors that then go on and are helping other people, it kind of creates a coalition where they all know we're in this together and you're not alone, and the shame doesn't belong to you. So it's really, I mean, the volunteers that come in and do that, they really are amazing.
So some of the volunteers you have remember what it was like to be isolated and to be on the other end.
Absolutely.
And they want to give back.
Right.
Christmas time is, you know, of course, supposed to be a time of charity, of love, of peace, but it's often a very stressful time, especially with families. Have you found that you get a lot of calls at Christmas, and what has this past season been like?
Well, historically, usually around the holidays, beginning right before Thanksgiving and going into the new year, historically we have been rather quiet. Our phone lines are down, the number of walk-ins
really?
That we get are down, and our shelter census is down. And for the first time in my 17 years at the agency, this past holiday we've been full nearly to capacity in our shelter. The number of people calling and walk-ins has not decreased at all, and we really don't know what that's about. It'll take a little bit for us to get some analysis around that, but we were just remarking how incredibly busy we were. So there's that kind of the difficult side of it, but you mentioned the charity, which is the other side of it that we get to experience, again, in our volunteer program and the Giving Tree program. Denise, if you want to talk about how exciting that is.
We have a fabulous program. It is our Giving Tree program, and we invite clients of ours to participate, and they get to make a wish list. So many of them do not have the ability to purchase gifts for themselves or purchase gifts mm-hmm. for their children, and we want to help make that Christmas dream a possibility. So we have, again, our fabulous community coming in, and whether it's individuals, it's community organizations, businesses, come in as donors, and they are matched up with families, and they receive the wish lists of our families, and the families are told to dream big. Something that always strikes me is when you a family is given a wish list, and the children come back, and what they're wishing for is socks and underwear. And as a mother,
wow.
that just breaks my heart that
yeah.
this is what their Christmas wish list is. It's socks and underwear. These are things that you know, for many of us, we just don't think about having to provide that for our children. And, you know, and they're told they dream big, and it's always fun to see that. And then the amazing thing that happens is the items start to come in as the donors purchase the items, and they bring them in, wrapped, and then we get to make this great call. Your gifts are here.
Oh, man.
If you ever lose faith in charitable and feeling of humanity, come to the women's community around Christmas time mm-hmm. and take a look at what this community does for people that they don't know. We just walk around with tears in our eyes at the amazement of the
it's
charity.
Wonderful.
It's amazing.
Jessica, I see you nodding your head.
Yeah, and then when the families come to pick up their items, there's even more tears because then, you know, they're so grateful, and just seeing the relief on their faces that they can provide, you know, for their children and have a nice holiday is really, really special. So a great big thanks to the community for participating in the Giving Tree program and making a holiday for so many families.
Jessica Lynn, Denise Lang, and Jane Graham Jennings of the Women's Community. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. What do you think of the Women's Community? If you live in Marathon County, if you've seen the new facility, perhaps you know somebody who has been helped by them, who's had to stay in the shelter. Perhaps you've had to stay in the shelter yourself. Maybe you know someone who's in an abusive relationship right now and wants to get out. Well, these are the people who can help you out and give you some advice. Maybe you've been in a relationship yourself and you want to share your story. We really want to hear from you. Our phone lines are wide open at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We've got Jane Graham Jennings, Denise Lang, and Jessica Lind of the Women's Community. And again, we do want to hear from you. If you've got a story to tell, a question maybe about what to do if you're in an abusive situation, or perhaps you know somebody who's gone through the Women's Community shelter or experienced some of the many programs that they administer, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. On your webpage, it says it can happen to anyone, and when it does, you need help to get out, start over, find answers, know what your options are, or find a network of support. You're not alone. Can it really happen to anyone?
It really can. People often have a stereotype in thinking about who this happens to, but it...
People usually think young women.
Right, right. And we serve a variety of people. It doesn't matter what your age is. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation. It doesn't matter your gender. It doesn't matter your ethnicity. Anyone who has been a victim of these crimes, we will provide services to. So I think... And again, we do provide services to men as well. The population, two things happen when we're serving men. One is it's just a smaller number. Statistically, this affects women more. They're targeted more. And secondly, in our culture, we still don't provide a safe way for men to ask for help. So there are still ways that we need to encourage and say when men are being hurt as well, they need to be able to ask for help.
Men aren't supposed to ask for help.
Right. And we want to make sure that people know we provide services to men as well, whether that's being a victim from a male partner or a female partner, or if you are a victim of sexual assault, which happens to men as well, or children. We work with boys who have been sexually abused also.
And you help out people in the Hmong community, the Hispanic community, so you've got a language difference there, gays, lesbians, and transsexuals, the elderly, and those with hearing disabilities. I'm sure each of these groups presents its own challenge.
Right, and that's one of the things that when we're providing our services, we have to try to the best of our ability to mitigate any obstacles that exist for victims from whatever community they may come from. So it's a lot of education that we have to get on our half as staff to understand what their needs are. And it's also important that we're working with people from within those cultures so that we can understand better and that they feel more comfortable asking from someone who, A, speaks their same language, B, looks like them, and C, understands what their additional barriers are.
How are the volunteers trained in dealing with minority populations, dealing with these special needs populations?
We have, as we go through and I'm working with volunteers as they come in, we have kind of kicked off a revised training program for our volunteers, and we cover those issues with them. I certainly haven't had anybody that at this point we've had any type of those issues, but mm-hmm. they certainly, we make sure that we're addressing it, and they know that, you know, they're going to be, for some people, they may be coming in contact with an individual that maybe they aren't aware that they have never talked with a blind person before.
And, right.
I mean, it's things that... you just don't normally think about, you don't talk to a blind person really any differently than you talk to you or me. But,
there
you know,
you go.
I mean, it's one of those things that kind of gives a hiccup to anybody who, how do I handle this? You handle it normally. So we make sure that they're prepared for that. If they have questions, they certainly have
You handle it with empathy and understanding.
Absolutely.
And respect. It must be particularly difficult dealing with children who have been abused or sexually abused. Jessica, that's got to pose a particular challenge for you.
Yeah, it absolutely can be very challenging and very heartbreaking. But unfortunately, in our community, we do have a number of children who have been sexually abused. We have a great, again, response team within Marathon County. We have a Child Advocacy Center of North Central Wisconsin, in which we're part of a response team, again, with a forensic interviewer who is specialized in interviewing children. And so our advocates respond to the Child Advocacy Center, and we meet with families who've been impacted by child sexual abuse. So our role as an advocate is to sit with the family and answer their questions, make sure that they're connected to the community resources, offer them our services, and really just provide emotional support for them. And as Shane was talking about, you know, we see a lot of males coming through the Child Advocacy Center, whether they're boys themselves who have been sexually abused, or certainly parents. We meet with lots of fathers, stepfathers, mm-hmm. boyfriends, siblings who are impacted by sexual abuse in our community.
How do you deal with children? They're not adults. It would seem like you might have problems even identifying who the victims of abuse are. And then when you're dealing with them, what happens when you have to deal also with parents? Sometimes the parents are the abusers. It's part of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and working with children is really one of my favorite parts of my job, is to just let them know that they're normal and that what has happened to them, wasn't okay and wasn't normal. But again, making sure that they have a safe place to go and that they have supportive parents and families. And that's where social services really comes in to play in those other system pieces. But as advocates, we're really making sure that parents are connected to community resources, and really just being a support for parents, because when something like this happens, it's really quite traumatic for a family. And so just making sure that parents know that they have someone that they can call and say, hey, I've had a really tough day today. I've been thinking about what happened to my child, and I just need someone to talk to. And that's what advocates are there for. So people can call us anytime, 24/7, just to kind of talk about what's happened.
And I think it's really important. One of the things that we always take opportunities to talk about, because the idea tends to be so abhorrent that someone would harm a child, especially sexually harm a child, that when children disclose, they are often not believed. And so the message we want to send to everyone, because as you mentioned, Glenn, most often it is someone known to the children, known to the family, someone that they love and trust. And that is why sexual abuse is so devastating, because it destroys not only a physical part of a child, but their trust in the people who are supposed to protect them, that our culture says your parents, your caregivers are the ones who love and take care of you. And when they violate that trust and that role, it really affects children. So kind of as adults, when kids talk to us, it is often our immediate response is denial. And so the message we always want to send is, if your child tells you something, believe them. Just believe them and tell someone. Make a report about it. The authorities and our systems work will figure that stuff out, but you've got to tell.
Children who are abused, do they often, or at least sometimes, go on to become abusers themselves? Is this learned behavior that's passed on from generation to generation?
It certainly can be, but again, it doesn't mean that it's automatically going to be. There's a lot of research that talks about certainly witnessing domestic violence or being abused in some way. You might then have more likelihood to become an abusive person, but it certainly doesn't mean that you're automatically going to be. There's a lot of research out there who, children who witnessed abuse or have been abused themselves grow up not to be abusive, and they can certainly break that cycle of violence and not behave in that manner. So it certainly is a learned behavior, but again, there's a lot of research that supports.
The thing that, and again, to remember about those behaviors, it's always a choice. Mm-hmm. So there are hundreds and hundreds of victims that we've worked with who were exposed, who were abused as children, but they did not repeat that behavior. Mm-hmm. So it can be a learned behavior, but it's always a choice, and many, many victims learn a different behavior and they don't repeat it as adults. So especially if they get intervention in there early, that's what's really important. And the, another thing about that, just for our service purposes, we are specifically designed for victim services only. Mm-hmm. We are actually prohibited from providing services to offenders. There are other programs in the community. Peaceful Solutions Counseling provides kind of like our counterpart to the people who use violence to help them change their behaviors.
How often is that successful? I know you don't do it yourself, but you deal with the problem of abusive men, abusive behavior. How often are men able to turn their lives around and put all of that behind them? It seems like it would be a very difficult thing for some of these guys to do.
Well, it's really interesting. The data kind of plays out that it can be very successful. Again, that's always a choice. And so in our culture, for those people who use violence that want to change, they change. But our culture yet doesn't quite create an incentive. You know, we're creatures of habit, and so things that we're used to doing, we continue to do. And unless we're given a really strong reason to change, we don't tend to. So that's what the programs are about in the offender treatment. And we work very closely with the facilitators of those groups and who also do the individual support, because we need also to separate out many victims that we work with. They don't want the relationships to stop. They want the abuse to stop. And so if we separate out the behavior from the person and say this behavior needs to change, these people can be different. And certainly mm-hmm. we've seen that. We ourselves have seen families reunite, and it turns out to be okay. But the offender has to be willing to change that behavior.
We're talking to Jane Graham Jennings and Jessica Lind and also Denise Lang of the Women's Community. And we want to get some information out to you. If you're in an abusive relationship, if you want to find out more about the Women's Community and what they might be able to do to help you, their website is womenscommunity.org. That's womenscommunity.org. And they do have a 24-hour confidential hotline at 715-842-7323. That's 842-7323. Or you can call them toll-free at 1-888-665-1234. 888-665-1234. I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Mulberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Our guests today are three of the women of the women's community. And if you would like to join the conversation, if you've got a story to tell, if you know somebody who's been in an abusive relationship, if you've got questions about how to get out of an abusive relationship, if you know someone who's been at the shelter, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Jane, to what extent is poverty and financial stress a factor in all of this happening?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question in that many of the people that we see tend to come from lower income homes. And I think what we know about that is more so not necessarily that that's who it's happening to, but those are the folks who tend to ask for help more often. And it's kind of a psychology around that. People with better resources, more resources, who are maybe more affluent in the community, feel like they have more to lose mm-hmm. if they would come to our services. And they may have other resources that they're able to just go away. You know, if they have physical injuries, they can go and take a vacation until it heals and keep that a little more private. They just don't tend to ask for help in the same way that people who are impoverished, they have nowhere else to go.
If you've got money, you've got more options.
That's right.
You know, it's the story of our society. But what about alcohol and drugs? How often are they involved in violent, abusive situations?
When we're working with law enforcement tell us that they think about 99% of domestic abuse calls that they respond to involve alcohol in some way. So it certainly is correlated. We have to be real cautious, though, that we don't think it's causal. Alcohol does not cause abuse. And in talking with the treatment providers for people who use violence, what they say is you're dealing with two problems. You have someone who needs to stop using alcohol and someone who needs to stop using violence. And those things are co-occurring things that need to be addressed. stopping alcohol doesn't stop abusive behaviors. They have to happen at the same time.
So the alcohol and drugs may be a contributing factor, but certainly not an excuse.
Exactly, exactly.
Are there traditional cultural attitudes that play a part, old stereotypes of the roles that men and women are supposed to play, and the men get upset when the women get too uppity, they get too independent, too worldly, too self-sufficient?
As much as people might argue otherwise, we still certainly have a male-dominated culture, and we have very rigid gender roles still. And so what plays into the power and control, and that's something I think is really important for that I want people to understand about violence and what the women's community provides. Physical abuse is not the only abuse that we are addressing. We address a continuum of violence. So we address people who are in relationships that they feel so much less than because they are verbally abused. We provide them the same services if they come to us that we provide to someone who has been strangled. So we look at a continuum because mm-hmm. someone who you're in love with who uses verbal assaults to keep you in your place and maintain control over you, that has just devastating effects also. So we are looking at that whole continuum.
You know, and if you want an example of how we have a male-dominated culture, they just swore in the new Congress today. And there was a wonderful picture of all the women members of Congress on the Capitol steps. And there are quite a few of them, but you know what? There are many, many more men who are serving in the Senate, serving in Congress. We've never had a woman president,
right.
You know, across the board. It is a male-dominated culture. We've heard, when we're talking about culture, we've heard some heartbreaking stories in the past few years in the Hmong community, where Hmong women are abused or killed by their men. Are there old cultural attitudes at play here? And I think the answer is yes, because we had the Hmong leader, General Vang Pao, who was in town a few years ago, the late General Vang Pao, who addressed the Hmong community and said, you've got to change some of these attitudes.
Yes. We have an amazing group of Hmong advocates that teach us so much. Obviously, we still have so much to learn, but they really help us understand what's going on. And certainly, there are some very strict culture guidelines that exist within the Hmong community for people who adhere to very traditional values. A lot of that is a cultural just change. They've been here several decades now, but for folks who came here as their first place out of Laos, we suddenly expect them to completely disregard everything that they knew to be. And I think we need to be a little more patient and understanding with that. And the Hmong advocates help us understand things that they can try to address, but also help us understand what is really important within the community.
And going from a tribal community, essentially a tribal right. culture, into 21st century America is quite a leap. And
right.
it is amazing how the people in the Hmong community have adapted, how they've learned our language, how they're getting their
yes.
kids are getting grades, incredible grades in our schools, and their Hmong people are running some of our companies right now
yes.
and achieved many positions of prominence.
And one of the things that's actually occurred from Mao Kang, who's one of our Hmong advocates, that she was part of a group after General Vang Pao was here and challenged the clan leaders within that culture. Men are in charge of kind of the communities, and those are the elders that people go to help with their family problems and with disputes. And she was part of a group that got for the 18 Clan Council of Wisconsin, which is kind of a group of the Hmong male leaders. There are now women serving on that council.
Mm-hmm.
And so they know that until women are part of the decision-making, nothing changes for Hmong women. And so she's been instrumental in getting women in the leadership roles, which is something that is very new within the culture.
And really, don't we find some of these same cultural attitudes about traditional male and female roles in portions of our wider Anglo population?
Absolutely, we do.
And our society, too, it just seems awash with images of violence in our movies, demeaning sexual activity, pornography, our video games, even our advertising. All of this inundation of this sexually explicit, violent culture, it seems to be everywhere.
It is
everywhere. It is definitely everywhere. I think, you know, society sends these messages out and how we treat people, in particular women, when it comes to sexual assault. You know, take so many different movies and you see a woman being violently beaten and raped in the movie, and what message does that send to our young boys who are growing up to be men? In video games, we're seeing it there. And so certainly it allows people to think that this is how we treat women. And so I certainly think that the media definitely has a role to play in all of the different movies that are made or videos that are created and how we treat people, definitely.
And I think in our advertising, if you look at the advertising that takes place, and we're told that this is what the culture wants, but actually they're shaping what we are believing and sending us images. And there's studies around the images that are portrayed of women in that, and the response that that creates within young men, which is to dehumanize, objectify, and treat women as less than. And it is a real research-based problem that young men are seeing images of women that are unrealistic and thinking that they are less than human.
Talking to Jane Graham Jennings, Denise Lang, and Jessica Lind of the Women's Community. Again, you can find them on the web at womenscommunity.org. And that 24-hour confidential hotline can be reached at 715-842-7323, 842-7323, or 1-888-665-1234. That's 1-888-665-1234. I'm Glenn Moberg. We've got Jane Graham Jennings, Denise Lang, and Jessica Lind of the Women's Community. Let's talk about why people don't leave abusive relationships.
Well, there are a variety of reasons. I think we can never forget that there is a tremendous amount of fear. And really, we can never overlook the fact that people die, in particular women, die in violent relationships. What we know about domestic abuse homicides is about 80 to 85% of homicides occur after a woman has left the relationship or when she has threatened to leave.
So she's actually in more danger after she leaves than when she's in the relationship.
Exactly, because what's happening in abusive relationships, it's about power and control, with one person believing they have the they're entitled to control another person. And so when a victim says, "I've had enough, I'm done," and leaves, they have cut that control, and it tends to escalate the danger level. So we can never underestimate that. And the threats that go on behind closed doors, many things that we never ever hear. So when a woman is murdered by someone who claims to love her and those headlines are splashed out there, that is an effective tool to silence other women. It's also extremely effective to silence other women to threaten to kill the children. And that happens as well. And so when we see those headlines where these children were killed by their father, that message gets sent very well to all of those women who are living those situations in fear that if they ever leave, they'll never see their children again.
Okay, so you have a woman who comes to your shelter. She's been in a violent, abusive relationship. She's there for 20, 25 days, and she leaves. How do you protect her when she's back out on the street again? How do you keep her safe? I mean, do you encourage her to arm herself?
We don't, actually. Domestic homicides, the number one weapon that is used in homicides and violent relationships are firearms. Guns are extremely lethal for domestic abuse victims. If their partner has a gun and they have threatened to kill their spouse or their girlfriend or their boyfriend or the kids, or threatened to kill themselves, that is someone who is really lethal. And if they have access to firearms, we're very concerned about that. The research that we also know about victims who leave and purchase firearms to protect themselves, more often those firearms are ended up used against them, that they don't actually protect them. So that's something we really have to be considerate of and think about when talking about arming yourself. It's not the answer.
Do you encourage women to have a safety plan, some sort of a,
yes,
itemize everything out? What am I going to do if I'm in this situation? How do I get out of it?
Yes. Safety planning is one of the things that we do on a regular basis with everyone that comes through our doors. And those are all individualized and all depend on each individual situation. So victims know better than anyone else what are going to be the triggers for their partner. Most of the time, sometimes they can't predict that, but most of the time they know, they recognize the signs that are coming. The fact of people coming into shelter and then they leave, the fact is when women leave our shelter, they go home. That's what they do. because there are many reasons, not only fear, but there are so many other reasons. They promised when they got married that they would stay married. They don't want the relationship to end. They want the violence to stop. They don't have financial resources.
Do these guys often promise that they're going to make amends? They apologize and say things
yes.
will get better?
That is what tends to happen. That's why they go home, because we believe that. When we're in a relationship with someone and they say something that hurts us or does something that we're hurt by and they say, I'm sorry, we believe them.
And is it true that an abusive relationship usually doesn't start all at once? It kind of starts slowly and then escalates?
That's been our experience. And
so you have women who want that guy. That guy they
married. Remember the person that they fell in love with. It wasn't always like
again.
This. Absolutely. And people are trying to figure out, I don't understand, you know, even if they don't have the resources, why would they live in that? And I kind of liken it to brainwashing. I mean, that's really what's happening, is it's the slow kind of occurrence of things that you don't really put together. And the individual tactics that abusive people use to maintain control, there's a lot of mind games and a lot of things that go on psychologically that victims in those situations start to second guess everything that they do. And if they're not getting any other input, if the only input they get is about how dumb they are or how ugly they are or how worthless they are, they start to internalize that, and it's a slow process over time until, you know, they often say to us, one day I woke up and I didn't know who I was anymore.
Jessica, does that pose a problem for you? Is that something that you've got to address in your work?
Oh, absolutely. I think that particularly, you know, along with domestic violence and sexual assault, many people who have been sexually assaulted are also, you know, sometimes in a domestic violence relationship. But certainly as an advocate at the women's community, working with everyone who's impacted by abuse, I meet with a lot of women who really don't know how they got where they are today, that like something that happens kind of over time, and after meeting with someone from the women's community, we can point out some of those things to them, and showing them the power and control wheel that Jane talked about, addressing the different tactics that maybe they're using to gain that power and control. So certainly we work with a lot of women and men who don't maybe recognize the signs of abuse until way later down the road.
And I think it's important too, Jessica, you know, when you're working with sexual assault victims, the thing about, you know, kids are most often abused by someone they know as well as adults. I mean, these relationships, these crimes don't happen most often in a stranger context. There are certainly stranger assaults that occur, but more often than not, you're dealing with someone who has been assaulted by a friend, a family member, a trusted someone, and it completely changes the way victims of sexual assault view the world. People they believed they could trust, and they start to question everything about themselves. If I believed in this person and he could do this to me, what does that say about my judgment?
Mm-hmm. A lot of trust issues for a lot of people because it is someone that they know and they trust, particularly with sexual assault, you know, being that it's over 92% of the time it's someone that you do know and trust. And for parents who have children and they were abused by, you know, maybe a family member or a babysitter or by an uncle, you know, it's very, very difficult for families to start to trust anybody again.
And Denise, this must also pose a challenge for the people you work with.
Yes, they, you know, whether they are providing child care during a children, or they're helping out with children's group, it manifests in ways that, you know, we just don't really think about, whether it's something that they say, or they may be working with children who, you know, they're at home and their mom is living with their abusive partner, and they were witnessing the violence last night. You know, certainly our on-call volunteer advocates who are responding to the ER, they are seeing, this is, talk about immediate impact. You know, that's something that we want to do, is also provide that support to our volunteers, because what we're dealing with is not an easy topic. So that's very important for me to explain to our volunteers, to know that there may be difficult things that you're going to hear, and that we have, you know, we as employees have a hard time processing. We want to make sure that communication is open for them to discuss.
And Jane, how do you and your staff keep your own psychological sanity? I mean, dealing with people in crisis, dealing with, you know, this range of human emotions, dealing with all of these tragedies day after day after day, how do you keep it together?
I tell you, Glenn, it does take a toll, and we have to actively work on separating issues, actively work on supporting one another. The other thing that we deal with is everything that we do is confidential. Not only is it state law that we don't disclose information about who receives services, but if we disclose that information, we lose our funding. So we can't talk to anybody. It's not like we can go home and talk to our partners or our spouses about our bad day. So all we have is one another. So we are hypersensitive to one another, and we, on a regular basis, talk about the fact that in this work, when you come to this work, you will be traumatized.
You have one another, and we're lucky that we have you. Jane Graham Jennings, Denise Lang, and Jessica Lind of the Women's Community, thanks so much for being with us today. That's womenscommunity.org, that 24-hour hotline, 1-888-665-1234. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, we interview Ann Speckhard, a Wausau native who recently completed a study of terrorism and published an 800-page book entitled Talking to Terrorists. It's going to be a fascinating show. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. Until next week, we're heading out of town.